Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show. Welcome to History 605. Today, on the first episode of Season 6, we have historian and senior editor Deidre Berzer. Deidre is the senior editor of the Research and Publishing Division at the State Historical Society and the editor of the South Dakota Historical Society Press. Not that all that doesn't keep her busy enough, but she's also working on a book of Rose Wilder Lane. Recently, an article about Lane was published in the South Dakota History, Volume 55, Number 3, that came out last fall. And I've asked her to come on History 605 and walk us through this very famous and influential person in South Dakota's history and in American history. Known more for being the daughter of Laura Ingalls Wilder than perhaps for her own writing, she should be understood on her own terms. So, Deidre, thanks for coming on History 605 and chatting with us about Rose.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, as your article opens up and you begin, Rose has no shortage of detractors. She has no shortage of myth makers and people who are otherwise upset with her. It would appear, and to be honest, it probably she was upset with herself from time to time. You've gone through her diaries and a lot of her writing. All of that seems to be a lot of great material to work through for a project such as yours. So I wonder if you can just get us kind of open us up. When did you first kind of interact with Rose Wilder Lane's work, and why did you start this project to write a biography?
So about 2 decades ago, I started teaching a course on Laura Ingalls Wilder's books. Mm-hmm. And in doing research for that, I encountered Rose. And I don't think that I had encountered her before. Or maybe I vaguely knew she existed from the first 4 years when she was a little girl, when she was born and she was a little girl. But I hadn't realized who she was in her own right before then. And so I just got really interested in her. And at that time, in the early 2000s, there was not much work done on Rose. And so I just started digging and collecting her own books and her articles and tracing what she did when. And I was astounded that she wasn't known better. And I did some looking into intellectual history. She wasn't there. Women's intellectual history, she wasn't there. And so I thought she'd been completely left out, both from a libertarian conservative point of view in terms of intellectual history and from women's intellectual history. Now, the classical liberals did pick up on her before anybody else. So I'm going to give them credit for that. And in the last 2 decades, a lot has happened actually to bring Rose to the forefront, or at least more than she was. And I think a lot more people are aware of her and her contributions today than were 2 decades ago.
Right. Well, one of those people is Nancy Copel and her and Pamela Smith Hill's edited version of Pioneer Girl, and then the follow-on books to that series, which is now kind of gone through in very, I don't know, some might say excruciating detail, but maybe.
Scholarly detail
about the writing process of how Laura took her first biographical accounts of growing up near DeSmet and Minnesota and so forth on the little house in the big woods all the way through taking that autobiographical work and turning it into fiction. The process revealed a ton about her and Rose's relationship. So that has certainly, and that's been a topic of some previous History 605 episodes with Nancy and with Pamela come on the show. But I wondered, so that was is kind of kicked over the anthill as far as you were concerned on a lot of that relationship between, or her development as a writer and a thinker?
Yes. So in the same issue of South Dakota History that my article and Rose appeared in last fall, Nancy Kupel has a piece on the first 4 years. And it's really the publication of the first 4 years that started some questions, because the writing was so different from the rest of the Little House series. And so people started asking and looking into the editing process a little bit and started wondering, well, maybe Rose was a part of this. And the first big biography that came out of that was called The Ghost in the Little House. And the premise of The Ghost in the Little House really goes way far over to Rose, like that Rose wrote the entire thing. Well, that's not quite right either. And so I think a lot of the classical libertarians have kind of picked up on that, and they really like Rose and they want Rose to be the writer, but that's not actually what happened. And so the Pioneer Girl Project that Nancy Kupel started and that Pamela Smith Hill did so much work on with Pioneer Girl really was able to trace who did what. And Nancy's take, and I think she's absolutely correct on this, is the best way to describe that relationship is a collaboration. And because Rose and Laura did not live in the same place for the latter half of the books, of the Little House books, they had quite a correspondence. And so we can actually see the conversations going back and forth about literary devices, which incidents from real life to include, what things are inside and outside the bounds of young adult literature. And those are the things that in Pamela Smith Hill's most recent book, Too Good to Be Altogether Forgotten, which she talked about on this program, she lays that out really beautifully. So that's where the kind of, where does Rose fit into this equation came up. And then since then, there's been more and more of looking back. Oh, wait, who was Rose? What did she do? But in her lifetime, she was extremely well known. She was publishing all the time. I mean, I can't even keep up with finding all the places where she's published.
Yeah. Do you think that we have everything, or that the majority of it wound up in the Hoover Library in Stanford, or at West Branch in the Hoover Library?
That's a really good question. So we know that Rose destroyed a lot of papers in her grief when her mother died. We don't know what. But certainly they kept a lot. And in terms of published material, the more things that get digitized, the more that we have been able to find. But I haven't found a complete list of her bibliography. I think that there's bits and pieces of it in different places. More and more is available. It's been a while since I've done a wide-scale database search, and now that I think I can ask AI to do that for me, and I probably should. It's been a while since I've done that, but there was a book, it's probably been out for 10 to 15 years, The Rediscovered Writings of Rose Wilder Lane, Literary Journalist, which is an edited volume by Amy Mattson Louders, and the University of Missouri Press has done a lot of publishing. And that book has a really nice compilation, actually, of Wilder's or Lane's writings.
Okay. Well, let's back up for a second. Why don't we talk about just kind of the demographics or basic events of her life? She's born on a homestead just north of DeSmet in 1887. The farming doesn't go so well. 1893 happens. The economy collapses nationwide. And I think that's the impetus for them leaving South Dakota. Is that correct?
That is correct. They do, they try a lot of different things. And it's not just the economic disaster and the drought, but it's also that her father, Almanzo, suffered from diphtheria, and so did her mother when Rose was small. And she ended up living for a while with her Ingalls grandparents in DeSmet. And Almanzo, as being the hardworking farmer he was, just pushed himself too early and too hard and ended up really damaging his legs and partial paralysis. And so he could not survive. He could not work. He could not walk in the climate, in the winter climate in South Dakota. And so they really needed to find a better climate for him. They tried the panhandle of Florida, and that was kind of a disaster. Laura Ingalls Wilder rather famously said something about, and I'm paraphrasing here, that with these like enormous butterflies, alligators, plants that ate rodents, all these things, the thing that was weirdest for the people in Florida was this Yankee woman.
Wow.
she was
a Yankee.
She called herself a Yankee woman. Okay. They couldn't have used the term Midwest at the time.
Sure.
But that's what like everyone who is in the North thought of themselves as a Yankee.
As a Yankee woman.
And so that didn't work out. They went back at that point to Spring Valley, Minnesota, where the Wilders lived, Manzo's parents, and stayed with them for a while. Went back to DeSmet. And then there seemed to be a lot of coming and going.
Did Rose go to Florida? Okay.
Rose, yes, she was a little girl. And then the story that she wrote in 1922 that won the O. Henry Prize, or second prize for the O. Henry short story competition called Innocence, is based on her memories. And it's a great story. It was actually anthologized quite a bit. There's a undercurrent of terror in there.
Yeah.
That you have to wonder if that's what she remembered, that undercurrent of terror. It's an excellent story. But after they were back in DeSmet, some friends had checked out that corner of Missouri, the Ozark corner around Mansfield. It's the land of the big red apple. And they liked what they heard. They thought the climate would work out. And so they headed there. And then they were just, I think, really shocked, Laura and Almanzo and Rose, to encounter people who were heading to Dakota. Right? Like everybody was on the move trying to find a place that was better than the one they left behind.
Yeah. Well, that tells you the topsy-turvy, the 1890s America.
Yes.
And then so how is Rose educated? Once they land in Mansfield, she winds up in Louisiana for school?
She attended the Mansfield school. Mm-hmm. She was really bored. She was probably kind of a snarky student.
Yeah.
Didn't think much of most of her teachers. Yeah. Read everything she could get her hands on. And she felt very... like country girlish compared to the town girls, because they didn't have money for nice clothes and shoes. And she had to take the mule. Spookendike was the mule's name, who was very cantankerous, to school. Sometimes they lived in town to make it easier for her to go to school. Almanzo ran a draying business, kind of freighting. Laura cooked for railroad men and different people who came through town. And so they just kind of made ends meet and kept adding to the farm. And so Rose was able to go to Crowley, Louisiana, to really finish high school. And that's where her aunt Eliza Jane lived. And and she did it all in 1 year, especially the Latin. She put all the Latin in. She hadn't had Latin before. And I think that learning Latin that way is really fundamental to patterning her brain, to her thinking patterns. I think it really gave her an edge.
She doesn't have a kind of a formal high school graduation then, but she at one
point. Yeah, she graduates. She's got a graduating picture, 1904.
1904, okay.
She graduates from Crowley, Louisiana, and then she goes right into learning to be a telegrapher. So she calls herself kind of this category of young woman, bachelor girl, because this is a new field for women, right? There are very few fields that women could work in as professionals, and this is a new one. And so she does that in a number of different places, including Kansas City, Mount Vernon, Indiana. So she's in different places.
What does that work involve? Can you? No, we don't hear that term so much anymore. What does that work mean? What does that mean?
So she was in some places. She was stationed like at a Western Union office, or there's a branch in a hotel.
Okay.
And then people would bring, like, they would need to send a telegram, and so they would come.
So she was the girl behind the counter who would type up telegrams and stuff. Okay. Okay.
Yes, or things would come in over the wire. Like she'd have to accept them too, that were being sent to hotel guests or wherever they were. So sometimes she'd work at the Western Union office pretty much all day, and then she'd have an evening shift at a hotel, like the big grand hotels that would have that kind of service for their guests.
Now, how does she get started as a writer then?
So she is doing this telegraphy in San Francisco, and she meets her husband, Gillette Lane, Claire Gillette Lane, goes by Gillette or Gil. Mm-hmm. And he was involved in real estate. And so once they get married, then she works with him in real estate in California. And then she starts kind of doing ad copy for that real estate, and it morphs into other kinds of writing. He has some connections with people in the newspaper business in San Francisco. And so she got started with that, was hired to work on the women's page. And this is around 1915 when she gets her start there. And
so she's editing and designing the women's pages.
Right. And, and she's writing for it. So she's working with a woman named Bessie Beatty, who gave her a start there. And this is, you know, not too far past the yellow journalism kind of age. And this is the argument that Amy Mattson Louders has made in her Rediscovered Writings of Rose Wilder Lane, that what she did was literary journalism. So Rose sort of would embellish these pieces that were supposed to be biographical or nonfiction, and in the service of a larger truth, she'd kind of play around with the facts. And that sometimes got her into trouble, like with Jack London's Widow Charmaine. And that biography she wrote of him was never allowed to be released.
she wrote a biography of Jack London that's still scrolled away today?
Somewhere, yes. And
really?
Shirley Chaplin. A guy named Art Smith. So she did a number of these biographies. So not long after she started writing for the newspaper in San Francisco, she also started writing for Sunset Magazine, which is more like a California feature pieces. Mm-hmm. So she did things on children in Hollywood movies, and you know, pieces like that, where she'd be on the set. She ended up being in a movie once. She's got some really fun pieces about things like that in a really engaging style.
And so she's there in silent films.
Yeah, like she was with Douglas Fairbanks. She kind of followed him around one day and was in a movie. I think that was the movie she was in the background for. Once, and she also starts, you know, the marriage is falling apart. Her mother comes to visit in 1915 for the World's Fair. I think it's a Pan American exhibition. Her mother's able to write about, every state has their own display plaza. And so her mother's able to write about Missouri for the Missouri Ruralist, which she was writing for at that time. And there's some speculation that the marriage was probably not working out by then, but they put on a good face
for Laura Ingalls
Wilder. Yeah. Yes. For mom's visit.
Yeah.
So the marriage, you know, falls apart. And gosh, I'm not remembering exactly what year this happened. I want to say 1909, maybe, that they had a stillborn baby boy.
Oh, right.
Who is a lot of sleuthing work located him and his grave in Salt Lake City. It's very hard on a marriage to go through something like that. So I'm not sure what happened, but maybe that was part of it. So that marriage falls apart, and Rose uses a lot of it as backdrop for her first novel, which is called Diverging Roads, which I think is actually pretty good. And Diverging Roads to me reads like a West Coast Great Gatsby, like the same kind of themes.
Huh. Is this Diverging Roads, is it still available?
Yes, because it's in the public domain. So it's been scooped up by different publishers who do that with public domain books. And and you can find it on your favorite online bookstore.
Right. So in this time of her life, when she's out in San Francisco and marrying, and then marriage is falling apart, what's her kind of political views? Are there notions of her, because ultimately she winds up, as we'll get to, becoming one of the first libertarians. Is that on the horizon? Is that notably on the horizon at the time, or has it come later?
I think she's farther to the left at this point, because the people that she trained with in San Francisco in the newspaper business, Fremont Older, was socialist. And also her aunt Eliza Jane was campaigning for Eugene Debs. And when Rose was living there and with her. And so she was exposed to a lot of that. And so she rather
socialist. She's socialist adjacent.
Yes, that's actually right. So when she leaves San Francisco, she has a job opportunity with the American Red Cross to go to Europe.
Yeah.
This is toward the end of World War One, and to write newsletter copy, basically, and trying to depict some of the scene of what's happening with the refugees and attempts to get food there. That's how she gets to know Herbert Hoover. But anyway, when she's before she gets there, she spends some time in New York City. And so she tells this story of how she was supposed to go to a Communist Party meeting, but she got sick and then she left for Europe right after. So it just didn't line up, you know, as something that worked out for her to go to. But, you know, she might have gone that direction.
Yeah.
She writes about that a lot. She goes to Russia and she's after the revolution, and she kind of, you know, she's wanting to see the ideal, and what she sees is not. And she talks to a lot of people. She meets with a lot of villagers, and she writes about all of this in a book she publishes in 1936 called Credo, which starts out as an article in Saturday Evening Post. And she talks to people who have been living in these communal villages for generations, and they say, this will never work. You can't take God's, the state cannot be God. It's just never going to work. Huh. And she kind of ponders on all of that. And then she has quite an adventure in Paris, not that Paris is communist, but with the bureaucracy of trying to buy a car. And she and her roommate buy a car, and they want to drive it to Albania in the 1920s.
As one does. Right.
They're really not roads. They do that eventually, but the problem is just trying to, you have to go through all the paperwork to get the car. And it took each of them working separately 6 weeks to try to get the paperwork for the car, and then it still didn't work out. So she wrote about that in a book called Travels with Zenobia, because they call the car Zenobia. It is hilarious. This is very
well
funny.
That would be so I'm sure that's just a screed against bureaucracy, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely.
The network of Parisian DMVs, right?
Yes. So it's just, I think all of her experiences in Europe, and she's in Albania, and just and seeing communist takeovers of places, and what that means on the ground for the people who live there.
It's not all rainbows and unicorns.
Peace keeps him in right.
Right.
Towards libertarianism, anyway.
So towards libertarianism, yeah. So let's, well, how would she, maybe this is too soon in her life to say, but ultimately, how would she define what libertarianism is? What does that mean to her? And she, she coins the term, right? Libertarianism.
Yes, she is credited with coining that term. So the experience of the New Deal plays a big role for her. She is very against the New Deal. She thinks, along with her parents, that government handouts really hurt human dignity. And so she becomes more and more interested in the human person, what motivates human action, and in liberty. And she starts making statements about this, you know, about 1936, 1938, as war is breaking out more and more in Europe, and she's afraid of what that will mean in terms of the curtailment of liberties in the United States if the United States gets involved. So she is really active in testifying in favor of the Ludlow Amendment, which would mean that the people would vote on whether or not there would be an entry into a war unless we were attacked. Before that could really happen, Pearl Harbor happened. So
this was something that was actually, I mean, and as you write in your article, 10 May 1939, Rose Wilder Lane testifies before Senate Judiciary Subcommittee in favor of the Ludlow Resolution. Yeah, I'm just reading the caption of the photo. The proposed constitutional amendment would have called for a national referendum on any declaration of war by Congress, except in cases when the United States was attacked first. So as things played out, the Japanese attacked and it wouldn't have come in. So if the House and the Senate declared war, then it would trip a national referendum and everybody would go to the ballot box and vote yes or no.
That's my understanding of the Ludlow Amendment.
Wow.
She had two quasi-adopted boys. And this is one of the things that I admire greatly about Rose, that everywhere she went, she wanted to create homes and families. Right? And so she would find these children who were on the street or had no family for whatever reason, were orphaned, and take them in. So she did this in Albania. And that young man, his name was Rex Mehta, she ended up paying for him to go to Cambridge. And then she was really worried about him in the war and trying to find him and protect him during World War II. I think she managed to get him to Britain. There were two boys who came to her door in Missouri during the Depression. She ended up taking them in. And so she was worried that they would end up in the military. And so she wrote a lot about that, you know, for during war and what's a mother to do, you know, kinds of things. And, you know, she has one article that's called something like, don't send your boys to war and don't send your boys to college and all these different kinds of things. You know? But yeah, she really internalized that, but she was thinking in terms of liberty and seeing where war had been a reason for governments to curtail liberties.
Okay.
And so she's moving more and more into thinking in large terms about human freedom and human liberty. And that's where she gets into what she ends up calling libertarianism, because that's her interest in trying to figure out in the first place why the United States of America had so much prosperity. That would have been the word she would have used. Okay. And so she looks at the American Revolution as unleashing energy. And this is a way that a lot of people in the 1930s started talking about human potential was in terms of energy, right? So a friend of Rose's, Isabel Patterson, has a book that talks about the same kind of idea with energy, like human dynamo. And so that's one of Rose's worries. Like, what happens to the United States of America when that kind of energy is tamped down? And she saw that happening with the New Deal and then the war. And so she's constantly now in the public eye writing in all kinds of places. So she kind of stops writing fiction after 1938 when she publishes her novel Free Land. And she had done all kinds of short stories that were serialized, and then she was able to publish them as novels. And that was really the ideal way to do that if you were writing fiction, because then it's like double dipping, basically.
Sure.
Why not, right?
Why not?
She started writing nonfiction. And I think it had gotten harder and harder for her to come up with story ideas for fiction. But nonfiction, she had a lot to say. About 1936, she's doing a lot of nonfiction. This Woman's Day magazine begins, and I think in 1938, and she's able to publish a lot there. Then she starts in 1941 writing for the Pittsburgh Courier.
Yeah.
And that column is called Rose Lane Says. She really works out a lot of ideas there. And the Pittsburgh Courier is the largest circulating Black newspaper of the day. And so she was really interested in the other people who were writing for that. And they did kind of have this conversation going amongst themselves. And she relished that. That was great. And then she had some really big or things she was able to make big things happen to her during the war. She had a little dust up with the FBI.
Little dust up with the FBI. They come knocking. Right.
I don't know if she set this up. It's kind of funny. She was very good at dramatizing things. And so she wrote this big piece about this. What is this, the Gestapo? But she had written a postcard, right? And so if you don't want people to read what you're writing, a postcard is probably not the way to go. But she sent to a radio host in New York City who was talking in glowing terms about the social security system that had been created under Bismarck in Germany. And she's like, wait, we're at war with Germany. Why are we wanting to copy their methods? Like, that doesn't make sense. And so she didn't say it as nicely as that. So
in the postcard, she didn't say it as nicely as that?
Yes. She was disappointed.
And then the postal officials read this and alert the FBI?
Oh, yeah. So the post office clerk in Danbury, Connecticut, where she lived, put it aside, sent it to the FBI as being suspicious. And so they sent an underling over. I think it was like a state trooper that they kind of sent out. And she was out working in her flower bed and, you know, felt very attacked, really. Like, how dare you come onto my property and make these accusations? Yeah. And so she, in her words, let him have it. And so we can now, we can see that FBI file, and it kind of seems like...
much ado about nothing.
Yes, and Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover,
yeah,
who ran the FBI at that time, was like, if we don't have better things to do with our time than this, what are we doing?
had a flash of common sense.
Yes. So it created a big splash. It got a story that got picked up in a lot of different places. And the other thing she did during World War II that got picked up in a lot of places is she refused to deal with ration books. So she just raised everything on her. She had a little farm, Danbury, Connecticut, and canned everything. But was really public about that, and that she wanted to make as little money as possible so she didn't have to pay taxes. So she was really public about that too.
Well, she sounds like a fury. As how does she come to the notice then? It's probably all these things that William Buckley calls her one of the three furies of 1943, Isabel Patterson, Ayn Rand, it's infamous or good company to be in, and Rose Wilder Lane. They're the three furies, according to William Buckley.
Their big books were all published in 1943. So that was the year that the discovery of freedom.
Okay.
Man's Struggle Against Authority is the subtitle. Rosewater Lane published that book in 1943. And Isabel Patterson's book and Ayn Rand's, one of her novels, all came out that year. Yeah, so they're three furies. And Buckley,
Buckley was in college at the time, though.
Yeah, he probably made that comment later, not that year.
But he probably read them. Are those books, and is Rose Wilder Lane's political nonfiction, is this still assigned today? Do people read her today?
Yes, those are all available. Are they assigned?
Are they out there?
Probably not. I mean, but are they out there? Yes.
It strikes me that she's far more well-known for supporting her mother's work and participating in her mother's work and helping her mother's work get done than she is for her own nonfiction today. Do you think, is there a launch pad to change that, or heaven forbid, do we want that? Or I mean, certainly she's a remarkable woman. There's no doubt about it. I can just motoring from Paris to Albania in the early 20s was not something for the faint of heart, right? She definitely loves adventure, and she certainly knows how to craft a story.
Yes,
and then with her political views, I mean, it seems like she's an Ernest Hemingway in her own way. Not the kind of, I mean, maybe he is. He's a Rose Wilder Lane in his own way. I don't know. But,
so I think that with the discovery of freedom, like, she knew that it wasn't going to reach a lot of audiences. It maybe sold 1,000 copies in her day. It's probably sold a lot more than that in the last 20 years. Her mission was to create networks and start conversations. And she writes about that in her correspondence. And I think that was certainly successful. She did, at least following the threads in all of her correspondence, which is enormous, voluminous. She did create these networks. So after she does the discovery of freedom, and when she stops, and we don't really know what led to the end of her Rose Lane Says column with the Pittsburgh Courier, but she does have a column in Woman's Day magazine and continues writing for them even up until her death in 1967. Like, they went to Vietnam for them and was a Vietnam correspondent. Like a feature kind of pieces. That's a good outlet for her. She was the
age of review editor. I mean, she would have been in her late 70s.
Yes. She died right before she was about to go on an around the world trip.
Oh my God.
Like the night before.
Wow.
And that was for Woman's Day magazine as well.
Okay.
So she, in the late 40s and 1950s, was a book review editor for the National Economic Council's Review of Books. And she did some speaking, and I've been trying to figure that out. I know that she was a speaker, like a lecturer, one-time lecturer at Grove City College. It's in Erie, Pennsylvania. There was a student at the time who got to know her really well from that visit. He was a little older because he had gone, he'd fought in Korea, and then he went to college, and he had was married, had children, and his name was Walter Grinder, and I did an interview with him. He's passed away since then, but that visit of hers to Grove City College started a friendship, and his children called her Aunt Rose, and now Grove City College doesn't seem to have any record of that happening, but okay. I think that she must have gone to some other places. She also got involved with, it's called the Freedom School in Colorado, and helped pay their mortgage sometimes, actually. Wow. So she was in these libertarian circles. Hmm. So that's what she wanted to do, really, just kind of to shape conversation one person at a time. And so she loved the way the Freedom School went. Like, they had this like small cadre of students who would come, especially in the summers, college students. And she thought that method was right on. You start with a small group and just present them with ideas and see what they do with them.
Let's shift a little bit and talk about, you make the point in the article, and others have made this point too, that she and her mother, when it came to fiction, knew how to craft a story. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, or fill that out a little bit more about, maybe Pa Ingalls is certainly a storyteller, and he would have been influential when she was a very young girl.
Yes.
What's Pa's influence on her notion of what a good story, craft a good story?
Well, we don't know for sure beyond conjecture, but she does have a piece she wrote called Pa's, or Grandpa's Fiddle.
Oh.
That's kind of her memories of their last night in DeSmet before they leave for Missouri. It's a beautiful article. And so she can kind of tell like what his music meant to her mother. I don't know that she's said for sure about Pa's influence, but she has pretty distinct memories of Ma, of Caroline Ingalls, so her grandmother, and of her aunts, and she talks about in those pieces. I think Grace helped her learn how to read. She could read at a very early age. I think it's just the environment of storytelling, right? So we know from Little House in the Big Woods, especially about Pa's stories. And in Pioneer Girl, one of the things that Laura Ingalls Wilder said was so important to her was saving Pa's stories, that they were too important not to save. Yeah. That whole ethos of storytelling must have surrounded Rose as a little girl, right? In the Ingalls household, in her own household, her mother telling stories. And so she understands the importance of story and how to tell a good story. I think kind of it's in her blood.
Do you think trying to explain her political views, she would structure her presentations to the Senate or her news articles or nonfiction based on a good story? You talked about earlier how she might embellish things when she got started at the San Francisco paper and add things for a broader truth.
Yes. But
she wouldn't say she's doing that irresponsibly, right? To be purposely misleading, or which maybe she would, I don't know. But where's the fine line? I mean, you and I as historians would be held to account, probably by our colleagues, if we published something that was untrue in order to make some broader point. She's inspired by her political views or ideology, and how would she explain the justification of that, writing the broader truth rather than the facts, I guess, as some people might say. That might be too hard to answer, but I'll have you take a stab at it.
The broader truth, a universal truth, is more important, right? The principles are the important thing for her.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps if she hadn't jumped into writing at the moment she did, she might not have found her way. I like the literary journalism term. I think it gives you a pretty good label, if you're looking for a label for what she does at that time. And then she takes that skill with her. There are some times where there's some controversy about the Little House books and that they're not completely true. And of course they are fiction, and they're in the fiction section, but because Wilder used actual names, yeah. and the outline is true, though not always chronologically yeah. correct. It gets in this kind of murky area.
Right.
And so Rose would say things like, everything my mother wrote was true. And I think she's trying to say these larger truths, but that's not always how the audience would hear what she was saying. So yeah, right, there's right. definitely in her lifetime, yeah, some conflict, some tension about that writing device, we'll say. But in terms of yeah. the collaboration that Rose and Laura are able to do together, I mean, Rose was an excellent editor in helping her mother do this thing called show, don't tell. And it's a very important aspect of any novel. If you've ever read a novel in which you feel like the author through the narrative voice is hitting you over the head with something or telling you, mm-hmm. you should feel sad about this. Uh-huh. So the best example of that that comes to my mind is when in Little House on the Prairie, when the dog Jack is lost, when they have a very hard time fording a creek that rises really quickly, and Jack is trotting behind the wagon and then he's lost. And the narrative voice doesn't say Laura was really upset.
Right.
It says Laura felt like crying. She knew she shouldn't cry, but she was crying on the inside. Yes, I'm paraphrasing, yeah. but something along those lines, right? So we are not told how we're supposed to feel. We see it through the action, and that's what makes for a much stronger piece of fiction. In that, right. that's something that went back and forth in the correspondence between Rose and Laura all the time. Right. Okay, you got a show, don't tell, and it's from Laura's perspective. So all of the books are from Laura's perspective, except for Farmer Boy. And then whenever Almanzo shows up, we see things through his perspective, so which shows how important he is.
But is Rose the one telling Laura show, don't tell, or is that
yes,
Laura?
Teaching her that to begin okay. with. Yeah. And then okay. helping her figure out, because there are things they want to tell that Laura wants to tell, stories.
Right.
They have to figure out, okay, so she wasn't there. It wouldn't make sense for Laura to be there as a character. So how are they going to do that? How is she going to see this through the eyes of whatever character is experiencing that?
This has been a great conversation, and I'd point folks and readers to our South Dakota History Journal. Again, that's last fall, 2025 fall, Deidre's article about Rose Wilder Lane. And I guess I'll just wrap up with one of the stories. You mentioned Pa's Fiddle, and that was one of the first things that I did not know that until you just told me that this was one of the first things that Rose wrote. The South Dakota State Historical Society's museum used to, and some folks older than, I would say, 70, would recall seeing Pa's Fiddle in the State Museum. We no longer have Pa's Fiddle. It's back in Mansfield, Missouri, at the museum there. And the reason is because we made Rose mad. And by we, I mean the State Museum had agreed to keep it was on loan to us. And we had agreed to play it from time to time. Well, Rose caught us in the act of not playing it.
Actually, it was Laura.
Oh, Laura caught.
Laura was still alive. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, Rose, I'm told Rose, and I've seen a letter where Rose.
Yes, it was a family decision.
yeah. To recall the fiddle back to Missouri. So. She, yeah, both women very, very strong in their opinions, as they should have been. Anyway, so if you're coming to the State Museum when it opens this fall, one thing you won't see, unfortunately, is Pa's Fiddle, unless you go to Missouri. But
yes, it's in Mansfield, Missouri.
It's in Mansfield, Missouri, at their museum.
Yeah, and Rose's piece on Grandpa's Fiddle is in a collection called A Little House Sampler that's edited by William Anderson. So there are a lot of great collections that have many of them by William Anderson, actually, that have put together pieces of Lauren Ingalls Wilder's writings and pieces of Rose Wilder Lane's writings. And so it's been a group effort, I would say, to bring Rose back into the limelight.
Mm-hmm.
So our own publication in addition to my article doing that, is our book of 80 different columns from Rose Lane Says. It's called Rose Lane Says from the Pittsburgh Courier. It certainly gives a really good flavor of her, of all the things that she wants to argue about politics and the human person and economics, all kinds of things.
Well, she's certainly worth reading and in order to understand the times we live in today. Wish you well with your further scholarship on Rose Wilder Lane and all the things that you do for the South Coast State Historical Society. So thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
This has been really fun. Thanks for having me, Ben.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats or the Republicans or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.